This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to the author of a new book that analyzes the strategy behind TV's longest-running game show and how we can apply those strategies in our everyday lives. Now, Northwestern University fired its head football coach, Pat Fitzgerald, last week after reporting from the student newspaper there revealed further details about a hazing culture on the football team. Multiple former players reported forced participation in degrading sexualized acts that they say were well-known within the program. Some of that hazing reportedly took place at a team training facility in Kenosha. Here in Wisconsin, a hazing and bullying scandal was reported on the Middleton High School football team last year that led to the resignation of their head coach. Those are just two of the latest examples in a long history of hazing controversies on sports teams, school settings, fraternities and sororities, the military, even some workplaces. These practices can cause significant mental and physical harm, even death for the victims. Groups across the country are working to stop that behavior. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Why do you think groups engage in hazing? What kind of things do you think we can do to prevent it in the first place? Have you ever witnessed or been part of one of these hazing incidents? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Elizabeth Allen is a professor of higher education at the University of Maine. She was the principal investigator for the National Study of Student Hazing, is the director of the National Hazing Prevention Consortium, which currently includes the University of Wisconsin. Elizabeth, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for inviting me. Good to be here.
We may have different thoughts or images pop into our heads when we think of hazing. Can you give us a standard definition that you work with for what qualifies as hazing?
Sure. The definition that we use and that's commonly accepted is that hazing is any activity that is expected of someone joining or maintaining membership in a group that endangers them, that humiliates, degrades, abuses, or endangers them, regardless of a person's willingness to participate. And what we like to point out with that definition is that there are three key components. So first is understanding that hazing involves that group context, that joining or maintaining membership. That secondly, it involves specific types of abusive behavior and or specific types of behavior that would be deemed abusive or potentially abusive. And thirdly, that it can happen regardless of a person's willingness to participate, which is really important because sometimes people think, well, it wasn't hazing because we gave them the choice of whether or not to do it. But that doesn't take into account that coercive environment that can be created in hazing situations.
How common is hazing, at least as far as we can tell, based on what is reported?
So based on the research that's been done, as you mentioned in the introduction, I was the principal investigator of a national study of college students and who reported on their experiences and perceptions related to hazing. And there we found that 55% of students who belong to some kind of club, organization, or team had experienced hazing. And we also asked them about their experiences in high school, and 47% had experienced hazing in high school. And other studies, another study, national study that was focused on high school hazing specifically found 48%. And so we know we've done some more recent data collection and analysis. The national study I spoke about involved more than 11,000 students. The more recent data, we don't have as many students or as many institutions, but we have found that the rates are lower, roughly between 25 and 30%, but those are on campuses that have implemented prevention programs.
Let's talk about prevention. Let's just stick with the college sports example. It's in the news, easy thing to talk about, I think. How can, say, a college athletic program, first of all, create a culture where hazing is seen as unacceptable?
Yeah, that is such an important question, and one that we've really been focusing on so much in recent years is really collecting data that will help to guide effective prevention. And you mentioned the University of Wisconsin is in the Hazing Prevention Consortium, so there are they are part of that effort, because we're not only working with them to provide assistance and coaching around hazing prevention, but also collecting data in the process. So to your question, what can an athletic department do? There's a lot that an athletic department can do, or a coach can do, or a team captain can do. And it doesn't boil down to one thing, but it's many things that can contribute to creating a healthier team environment or group culture where hazing is far less likely to occur. We have several resources on the Stop Hazing website that provide guidance around this, but it really boils down to positive like leadership and understand and trying to shift the norms that may have been in place that would contribute to a hazing culture. So if there were hazing traditions in the past, or there's a really rigid hierarchy where the expectations are that the newcomers do a lot of work of the group and the veterans don't need to do anything or feel they've paid their dues. Those are some dynamics that can be disrupted to help create a healthier culture where hazing is less likely to occur. And of course, it really is about how do you, you know, what are you trying to accomplish? If you're trying to accomplish building cohesion in a group, there are so many more healthy ways to do that than hazing. And so it's just a matter of figuring out and building the skills for how to shift away from hazing traditions and incorporate positive, healthy traditions that will accomplish some of the same goals that students are striving for.
Talking to Elizabeth Allen with the University of Maine, director of the National Hazing Prevention Consortium, looking at hazing in athletics and beyond after the firing of the head coach at Northwestern. Hazing comes to the Big Ten. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have thoughts on that Northwestern story, ideas on how to prevent hazing in any organization, join in at 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. John is with us in Brown Deer. John, hi.
Yes, good afternoon, and thank you for accepting my call. I played football at Northwestern from the years 1963 to 1967, and there was nothing that ever approached something like that occurred at Northwestern at this time. There was never any hazing, never any type of ritual that the football players were required to pass in order to be accepted. You were accepted as a football player and you earned your bones on the football field, not by dancing around in the shower. And Alex Agassi and Errol Parseghian never would have tolerated this. They would have anyone that would just was near it, that even was tainted by it, would lose a scholarship and be banned from or kicked off the football team.
John, I got to ask, having been part of this tradition of Northwestern football, as you see the stories and you're pointing toward the forced participation in nudity and sexualized acts of a degrading nature, is how players describe it. I mean, what does that make you think about what's become of this program you were part of?
Well, I think it's being tolerated by the coaches or the supervisors of the team. They must know about it. If something like that would have happened in my day, Alex Agassi or Errol Parseghian would have known about it. I mean, they kept strict watch and discipline on their football teams. There was nothing like this ever could have occurred. I was taken aback by this having occurred at Northwestern. I sort of lost a little bit of pride of having played there at that school.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that, John, but thank you so much for sharing that experience. Elizabeth, John pointing toward what he sees as strong leadership in his day, wouldn't have tolerated this kind of thing.
Absolutely. And I'm so appreciative of the call, because that is a really key aspect of prevention, is that visible leadership. Whether it's, like I said, from the team captain, the coaches, it's all of them matter. The university president, and in between, it's leaders really being clear about the expectations for what is appropriate behavior and what is absolutely unacceptable. And so we've found in our research that students report that coaches are often, or they believe coaches are frequently aware of the hazing that's happening. And it's a major problem for a number of reasons, but obviously, but also because students then feel like they are more reluctant to come forward and share their concerns because they feel that the coach knows about it, and maybe the coach might not be directly involved, but you know, isn't doing anything to prevent it or make a statement about it. And so it contributes to normalizing the behavior.
Thanks a lot for that call. And the coach Fitzgerald from Northwestern, now former coach, in a statement says, quote, "I had no knowledge whatsoever of any form of hazing," end quote. He says the investigation there confirmed that. If that's true, and let's take it away from the Northwestern case, hazing's happening, the coach really didn't know about it, is there still, in your mind, some responsibility on the coach for not knowing about it, for not creating a culture where hazing doesn't happen?
I do feel that coaches are responsible for creating a culture. And I know that many are working to do that. I've met many of them who are really proactive in creating a team culture where everyone feels respected, and where, you know, people are putting their energy towards the goal of being a team member and winning matches and games and so forth, and not towards the stress of being hazed or abusing others. So, yeah, I think it's absolutely a responsibility of the coach to be aware that hazing is a possibility, that there's potential that it could be happening, and to do whatever they can to set a tone. And again, as I mentioned before, expectations. In addition to setting a tone and expectations for the kind of behavior, it's really helpful to also be providing resources for students to know where they should go, being open to, you know, having students report to them if they have concerns. So, you know, keeping those lines of communication open and being transparent about expectations and related to hazing is key.
We're talking to University of Maine Higher Education Professor Elizabeth Allen, an expert on hazing, looking at hazing in the news in the Big Ten at Northwestern University and how to prevent it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about hazing, how it happens, why it happens? What efforts would you like to see taken to prevent hazing? Have you encountered it in your own career, athletic or otherwise? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Elizabeth Allen, professor of higher education at the University of Maine, director of the National Hazing Prevention Consortium, with us today to talk about the problems caused by hazing in athletic departments and elsewhere after a prominent scandal on the Northwestern University football team led to the firing of the coach there. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you encountered hazing in your life, or has maybe your kid? What questions do you have about ways to prevent it in the first place, or maybe you have some ideas? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Elizabeth, you mentioned positive alternatives to hazing. Now, we humans have a long tradition of, you know, initiation rituals to build solidarity among a group. What would be a better way to do this, say, on a football team, that doesn't involve hazing?
Yeah, that is a great question. And I'd like to mention a resource that we have if listeners are interested in hearing more. It's a 17-minute documentary style film called We Don't Haze. You can download it from our website, stophazing.org. But in it features a number of athletes from different colleges and universities across the country where they talk about alternatives and alternatives to hazing to help build solidarity and have positive initiations and traditions. Some of the things would be, for example, having a team meal together, going on a hike together or some kind of outing, doing a service project together. But really, I think it's super important to identify what the goals are. And once those goals are identified, make sure that those are in alignment with the values of the team and the organization. And this is where coaches and advisors can be super helpful. And then, you know, go from there. I mean, if the goal is to have a good time together and get to know each other, then why not all get together and go to cheer on another team on campus and sit together and, or as I mentioned, a team meal or some other activity that doesn't involve risking anyone's physical or emotional health. There are many, many different options.
How about reporting hazing? Because you could picture, you know, that new member of a team, say a high school or a college team, they experience a negative, I guess it's inherently negative, a hazing experience, but they don't want to, you know, have their whole team turn against them by reporting. They might even worry, you know, how's the coach going to react? Are they cool with this hazing thing in the first place? What do institutions do to provide an outlet to make sure that students can report it when it happens?
Yeah, so many institutions, because of that fear that so many folks have for coming forward, many have instituted anonymous reporting mechanisms. Sometimes there will be a hotline, and you know, other times it's a way that to file a report without having to provide your name that would be shared. Certainly, in many cases, confidentiality can be assured, but not always. It just depends on what the reporting party would like to see happen. So yeah, there are ways. I encourage anyone who has a report to share to look into the different options, because those options for anonymous reporting do exist in many instances. And I would say if that is not available, to inquire of a campus official or a school official, a trusted administrator, about what the options are for reporting, and then go from there. Often we find in our research that students report hazing to their friends and family members far more regularly, far more often than they do to a campus or school official. And often that's because they don't know where to report or who to report to. Sometimes they're not aware a policy exists. But, you know, I think there's also that fear. And so a lot of campus professionals and school administrators are working to really break down the barriers. And so there's been a lot of change recently to support folks in coming forward.
I wonder about kind of the self-perpetuating nature of hazing, where, say, in a fraternal organization or a college sports team, you're the first-year student, you go through it, and then by the time you're senior, hey, I went through it, I survived, it's tradition, I'm going to pass it on to this next generation, and we're going to keep it quiet, we're going to try to keep the authorities from discovering it. How do you break that self-perpetuating cycle?
Absolutely. I think that's a huge challenge with hazing. But what we found is that there are folks within who may have endured hazing and have stuck with the organization that really don't support it and would like to see a change. Part of the problem is that they often feel like they're the only ones who feels that way. And so it's really helpful to break down that misconception. And we have our research works to do that, to correct misperceived norms. But I think, you know, bottom line, I think that it just takes courage. And if you can find the courage to speak out, there are others who will likely step forward with you and will want to see the change. That's what I hear over and over again from so many people who have experienced hazing and don't want to see it happen again to somebody else.
Here's another misconception, and this is one of mine, I'll say, and based on our caller earlier, I would think that hazing is an old school, back in the day kind of thing, and maybe it pops up here and there, but it's mostly on the way out. Well, hearing from our caller earlier, he saw the opposite happen. It got worse since he was in school in the 60s. Hazing is still a problem. It sounds like, Elizabeth, that's sadly alive and well.
Yes, it is sadly alive and well. And I think more than most, people in the general public recognize or realize. And so we're working super hard to continue to get the word out that this is something that folks need to be aware of and know what signs might be and how to help prevent it and know where to go to report it if they do see it or if they're a bystander. Or if someone shares information with them about hazing. So yeah, there's still a lot of work to be done. The good news is that there is much more research and resources out there for prevention than we've ever had before. We still need a lot more, but we're at least getting a foothold.
Elizabeth, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Elizabeth Allen with the University of Maine, Principal Investigator for the National Study of Student Hazing, currently directing the National Hazing Prevention Consortium. She mentioned resources on hazing. Her organization has those resources online, Hazing Prevention, Hazing Alternatives. Find those online at stophazing.org. That's stophazing.org. We'll get a link up at wpr.org/centraltime as well. Tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, PFAS chemicals and a lot of our water supplies. We'll look at filters and other treatments. That's tomorrow on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we talk to the author of a new book about The Price is Right and what the game show can teach us about real-life decision-making. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with an answer to an audience question about art perfect for road trip season.
We recently received a Wisconsin question from listener Chris Murphy from Madison.
My question is, why are there a higher concentration of outsider artist environments in Wisconsin than anywhere else in the U.S.?
Great question. WPR's Tim Peterson asked a few experts to answer Chris's question.
Nick Engelbert's Grandview in Hollandale, Wisconsin. The Paul and Matilda Wegner Grotto in Monroe County. These are some of Wisconsin's artist-built environments. Ornate, meticulously assembled artworks on a massive scale using concrete, glass, auto parts, you name it. Here's Courtney Anderson Kramer, PhD candidate in the UW-Madison Department of Art History, who researches concrete sculpture gardens in the Midwest, like the Wisconsin Concrete Park in Phillips.
In general, a outsider art environment is going to be a space that is an artwork that is monumental in terms of its size and the amount of time that took to make, but also it can be monumental in the number of parts. So we're talking about the Wisconsin Concrete Park. Well, there are hundreds of sculptures on this site that the artist Fred Smith created over the course of decades.
Anderson Kramer says another example that was really influential on other artists in the region is the Dickeyville Grotto.
It is a monument to patriotism as well as Catholicism, and it is a sort of architectural grotto shrine that is encrusted with everything from geodes and rocks to Ford gear shift knobs, and the texture of the space is just stunning. It's like walking into a gem. It's beautiful.
Laura Bickford is an associate curator at the John Michael Kohler Art Center. She says this genre, like any art, is a cultural contribution and worthy of preservation.
these sort of art environments, I like to think of them as a genre-busting genre, where they're really made by people across walks of life who ordinarily maybe wouldn't feel that they were able to make works of art or wouldn't have access to a museum. And so they can really speak to a true way of the way that people are living on the land that they're living on.
And in the upper Midwest, in Wisconsin, in the early 20th century, people wanted to share their truth in the medium of concrete. And here's Anderson Kramer again.
At this time, you know, the 20s, 30s, even into the 40s, people are going, they're getting a bag of cement, and they're creating a garden border. They're creating a bird bath. They're creating bird houses out of concrete. So it's very much a part of gardening itself, using the concrete in the garden to make your garden beautiful. It just so happens that these artists really were bitten with the concrete bug and just continued to grow in their confidence, creating sculptural spaces, architectural spaces, adding concrete to their homes.
But is Wisconsin a leader in this type of art? Anderson Kramer says there's not really a concrete answer.
There's some truth and some not so truth to that. You can find these sorts of artworks anywhere in the world, but there are organizations in the Midwest, especially in the state of Wisconsin, like the Kohler Foundation, that has done a great job of taking care of these sites. But then there is some truth to it that there are a lot here, and that's owing to tourism at the time. You think of around the 30s and 40s when these are being made, we're seeing lots of tourism to the Dells, to Door County, and homeowners are kind of capitalizing on this traffic, creating artworks that are driving people to their homes.
Laura Bickford says downloading the map called Wandering Wisconsin is great for navigating to these sites. Though, she admits, the best way to find them is to never take the highway.
WPR's Tim Peterson brought us that piece on outsider art in Wisconsin, and a longer segment aired on WPR's Central Time. And that story idea? Well, it came to us from an audience question as part of our Wisconsin project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, in a new book, our next guest takes us on a journey to what he calls a strategic and mathematical wonderland. The Price is Right is the longest-running game show in television history behind 60 Minutes. It would be the second longest-running show, period. In its more than 50-year run, thousands of contestants have had the chance to win big and small. Turns out there's a lot of math behind the games on the show, and that can tell us something about our own real-life decision-making. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you watch The Price is Right, or did you back the day? Have you been watching for years, decades? What are your armchair game strategies that you think would help you win? What's a mistake that you yell at the TV when Price is Right contestants make? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Justin Bergner blogs at Pop Culture Math. He is the author of the new book, Solving the Price is Right, How Mathematics Can Improve Your Decisions on and Off the Set of America's Celebrated Game Show. Justin Bergner, come on down. You're the next guest on Central Time.
Thanks so much, Rob. Pleased to be on the show today.
Now, you are a fan of math and how it plays out in pop culture. What drew you to The Price is Right?
Sure. Like a lot of people in my sort of generation, I'm in, you know, mid-40s. I grew up watching The Price is Right during, you know, summers and, you know, snow days. And when I went to college at Yale, I graduated with a degree in economics and mathematics back in 1998. And I focused on game theory on the economics side and probability theory on the mathematics side, which gel very well with the show. And I thought about attending, you know, graduate school to get an advanced degree in economics and focus on game theory. But I chose to enter the business world instead. And I don't regret foregoing the academic path, but I always yearned to leave my mark in the world of game theory, which came together with this book idea shortly after college. I started working on it in 2000, briefly when I was between jobs using VHS recordings. I then found employment quicker than expected and tabled the idea for the next 18 years, beginning it again in 2019. So ultimately, writing this book was a consolation prize to myself of sorts for not going down the academic path, and an opportunity to share my love of game theory and probability theory with the world and with fans of the show.
And there's so much you write. It's a strategic and a mathematical wonderland. So much math and game theory behind the decision-making on The Price is Right. Could you give us a sense of how rich this show is with this kind of thinking?
Sure. So, yeah, there are four major parts of the show, as you know, viewers are aware. There's the contestants row bidding, where four contestants bid on an item up for bids, with the contestant who's closest to the actual retail price without going over coming up to play a pricing game. Then there are the pricing games, of which there are 77. Those are not game theory related because it's just you and the game. You're not actually competing with the other contestants like you are in contestants row bidding. Then there's the showcase showdown, where you spin the big wheel to get closest or exactly a dollar and one, or a combination of two spins, to decide which of the three players in the first half of the show and the second half of the show go to the showcase. And that's very much like a pure mathematical game theory exercise. And then there's the showcase, where the winners of the showcase showdown bid on attractive sets of prizes, usually valued between 20 and 40,000, at least back in a couple of years ago, seasons 47 to 48, which I use as a data set for my book. And that turned out to be a very sort of rich and interesting area for some conclusions as well. You know, ultimately, there's a lot of interesting math and game theory, but I would say that two-thirds of the improvement that contestants probably could create versus what's observed on the show is related more to behavioral shortcomings, and then the other one-third is related to, you know, strategy and math optimization. So it's really a combination of, you know, behavioral shortcomings and, you know, mathematical limitations that cause contestants to come up short in different parts of the show.
Well, let's check out this key moment. It's going to happen, I believe, nine times in every show. The visit to contestants row, where people come on down. Here's a listen.
The sewing machine goes to whoever bids closest to the actual retail price without going over. Good luck, everybody. Wendy, how you doing? You're first.
$550.
Thank you, Christopher.
$699, Drew.
$699. Thank you very much, Julia.
$750.
Thank you, Sandra.
$751.
Actual retail price, $3,148.
All right. Sandra, come on up. Let's get into the game theory of contestants row six times per game, of course. This illustrates two things. First of all, the strategy of bidding $1 higher than the previous high bid if you're in that fourth position.
Right. So, this example is perfect for a lot of the observations I draw in my book, because the three areas where contestants come up short is in underbidding on the item up for bids, mainly due to a fear of going over, but also just due to, you know, being more familiar with sales prices or the item being unfamiliar, like a sewing machine. You know, and secondly, there's this notion of anchoring, where, you know, the first contestant to bid bids low and then the other contestants follow. And then third is this notion of, you know, broadening your bid to actually create a bid that, when the dust settles, you know, captures a fair portion of the number line over which you could win over. So here for the sewing machine, you see a low first bid and you see the second and third bidders also bidding low. And then the fourth bidder just comes in and bids $1 over the highest price. And so, you know, if you look back over seasons 47 and 48, which was my data set, you know, 53% of the time, the highest bid won. And 64% of the time, when the last bidder tabled the highest bid, as occurred here, that contestant would win when they were bidding in the favorable last position. Of course, the final bidder should always bid $1 or a couple dollars if they want to be nice over one of the prior bids, or if they feel that all bids have gone over a bid $1. So this example is really perfect for, you know, what we observe most frequently in terms of the bidding sequences.
All right, this probably means I'm a big nerd, but now, Justin, I want to see an alternate version where all four people make a sealed bid. You know, they write it down and reveal it at the same time and see how that changes the strategies. Like, how could that shake up the game theory?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very different game, even though it seems very similar. You know, in that situation, And I sort of briefly allude to it in my book. You know, what contestants want to basically do is, you know, choose sort of a random number within sort of the sort of call it lower, you know, maybe two thirds or three quarters of the reasonable portion of the number line. So it's interesting on the show, the first bidder who has very little idea as to how to bid strategically often just tables his or her best guess with, call it a small discount or margin of safety, you know, not to go over. And that sort of is what you would expect sort of the average bid to look like in a sealed bid situation.
We're talking to Justin Bergner about his new book, Solving the Price is Right, How Mathematics Can Improve Your Decisions on and Off the Set of America's Celebrated Game Show. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Now, are you or have you been a fan of The Price is Right? Do you have a question about a particular game and the strategy behind it or thoughts on it? And outside of game shows, do you feel like you assess probabilities and odds in your daily life? For better or worse, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Justin Bergner, author of the new book, Solving the Price is Right, How Mathematics Can Improve Your Decisions on and Off the Set of America's Celebrated Game Show. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of the show? Hey, anybody out there been on The Price is Right? Love to hear from you if so. Do you have questions about the strategies behind the different games and events on The Price is Right? Join in at 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Okay, Justin, we heard, you know, the that first thing that people do on the show, Contestants Row, people often guess low. There's consistent badness there. But on the Showcase Showdown, you write, where you spin the wheel, you're trying to get 100. You did the math on optimal strategies, and it turns out contestants actually just their gut instinct or whatever, they do pretty well at optimizing.
Yeah, it's interesting. They, you know, individuals have a pretty good innate sense of probability. It's probably, you know, an evolutionary selected trait. You know, the contestants, if you're bidding first, you should, you know, not spin again if you are 70 cents or higher. If you're bidding second, you should not spin again if you get a spin of 55 cents or higher on your first spin, presuming you've, you know, overtaken the first spinner. And most contestants do pretty well. I mean, I think the second spinner might be a little bit too aggressive in spinning, not realizing they only have to beat, you know, one subsequent spinner. And the first spinner might be a little bit too conservative, not realizing they have to beat two subsequent spinners. But yeah, overall, most people make the right choice, and it leads to sort of very much, at least results that are very, you know, similar to a simulated, you know, set of outcomes.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Cyril is with us in Madison. Cyril, hi.
Hello there. I have another game show that also plays with numbers on Jeopardy, especially Final Jeopardy, where an answer is posed and the three contestants have to guess which is the right answer, but they also have to wager whatever portion of their current winnings to find out if they've wagered enough to win, because they have the highest total number.
Interesting. Interesting point, Cyril. Yeah, at Final Jeopardy, Justin, you've got to guess not just how confident am I that I'm going to get this right, how much to bid myself, but also how much are other people going to bid and how much are they think I'm going to bid? And then we're into game theory, right?
Right. No, it's a really good game theory question. I'm not, Cyril, thank you for the question. I'm not the expert on Jeopardy. I think there are some experts on Jeopardy that have either written a book or written sort of substantial sort of articles on how to best tackle the Final Jeopardy bidding. Very interesting show, very interesting game theory problem. but I can't say I'm an expert in it, unfortunately.
Cyril, thanks a lot for the call. Justin, there's so many sub-games, and you write about them and strategies. What to you, as you started to break down the, you know, the one-off games on Price is Right, what was the tastiest challenge for you when it came to math?
Yeah, I mean, there were a number of games that were sort of very probabilistic in terms of figuring out what you should do, like let them roll, where you roll five dice with three cars on three of the six faces and $3 values in the other three faces, and you can decide whether or not to stop and take cash or roll again, or spelling bee, where you're offered cash, or you can go on and continue trying to spell a car, C-A-R, with the letter C-A-R. So there are all sorts of, you know, trade-offs in a lot of the car games as to whether or not to keep the cash or play on for the car, which, you know, become very specific probability problems. I think there are a lot of interesting games as well that speak to people's behavioral biases. So I come up with a couple terms for some of these. So like strategic patience, contestants in a number of games, including range game, that's too much in card game, tend to stop the price meter, or sort of price in the process of increasing the price towards, you know, the value of the prize too soon. And most of the time when they lose, you know, whether it's an easy or a hard game, they end up losing by stopping too soon. I think that has a lot of interesting, you know, real world analogies to it.
You look for different examples like that, Justin, of examples in the game that might inform us in real life. You actually mentioned one earlier, the anchoring effect, where we have no clue what the number of something should be, a cost or whatever the number. Somebody throws out a number, it could be a random number, and that brings our brain into that vicinity. How important is it for us to be aware of those kind of biases in our mind when it comes to assessing values of things?
Oh, I think it's very important. I mean, it affects us in multiple aspects of life. I mean, the example that's most, you know, familiar to me as someone who's in the world of finance is, you know, buying a stock, it goes down, you wait until it comes back to your purchase price to decide to sell it, even though that's a completely arbitrary, you know, number that you're anchoring to. So it's something we're all very guilty of, some people more than others. And it shows up on the show like it does in lots of other areas of life.
Now, people on The Price is Right, you know, we could sit back and look from our TV, you know, the other side of the TV, and we're not under pressure, right? We're analyzing their decisions. How much do you think the excitement and maybe being on the clock affects people's ability to assess these things and make good probability adjustments, judgments quickly?
Oh, sure. I definitely think it matters. I mean, in this notion of strategic patience or not waiting, you know, for the price to go up to the value of the prize in range game, or that's too much. It definitely affects people on the show, but it affects people in real life when they have more time. I mean, in a personal finance decision, buying a house, we find a house we like, it's listed on the market. And instead of waiting, you know, 4 to 6 weeks for the seller to potentially lower the price and then negotiate against a lower price, we sort of get anxious and we act too soon. We negotiate against the initial list price and probably often pay more than we should for a new home purchase. So the time, I think, definitely exacerbates a lot of these shortcomings, but it doesn't mean that they don't exist when we have more time on our hands.
All right, just 20 seconds. I'm giving you the clock pressure, Justin. What game would be the most fun for you to play on The Price is Right?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I like the game Hot Seat, where it's somewhat complicated, but you have to guess higher or lower for five items. And then based on whether or not you're correct in those guesses, you can win up to $20,000. It involves math. It involves knowing what the prices of the prizes should be. And it involves knowing when to stop and keep playing for more money. So it's a lot of fun.
Justin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Rob.
That's Justin Bergner. His new book is Solving the Price is Right, How Mathematics Can Improve Your Decisions on and Off the Set of America's Celebrated Game Show. He also blogs, by the way, at Pop Culture Math. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll look at the effort to pass a defense spending budget and some controversial provisions passed by House Republicans. And the Women's Soccer World Cup kicks off this week with the U.S. squad widely seen as the team to beat. We'll get a preview of the tournament. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.